So, second midterm is on Tuesday. The format, pretty much the same as for the first exam. In discussing the exam with the TAs, we decided to reduce the number of points for each of the multiple choice quantitative questions at the end, but to increase the number of those. That is, the stakes in any one of those questions will be a little less. It won't be a bigger part of the total exam, but less will ride on whether or not you screw up any one of those. We thought that would make it a little bit better. I know it's an interesting, if you step aside from the fact that it matters to many of you, it's a kind of interesting thing, I think, about how people's brains work, that some of you did extremely well in the first exam, had no problems at all with any of the short answers, and there were some students who got all of the multiple choice ones wrong, who did very well on all the others, and of course that screws up your score. And that's, again, forgetting that it's painful for some people, of course. It's really interesting, don't you think, that that particular task, which you might think was an easier task, right? You might think at first glance that it's an easier task to be asked a question in which the right answer is staring you in the face, and you just have to pick it out of the crowd like a lineup, you know, in a criminal investigation. You might think that was cognitively a simpler task than just being asked the question and being asked to give the answer. And it just turns out that some people, for whatever reasons, that particular task turns out to be way out of proportion difficult and doesn't actually tap their understanding of anything. That it's, you know, it's a bit like other little cognitive glitches. I have a terrible time remembering names, including names sometimes of people I know really well. I'll just be in a party and somebody who I know really well, I can't retrieve the name. And I use that introspection about my own cognitive disability with respect to that particular task as a way of kind of having more empathy for a task that I find just trivial. I find it totally simple. Multiple choice questions just seem to me sort of a waste. I just cross off all the ones that are obviously wrong, look at the remaining ones, and then if I know the right answer, it just jumps out at me. But I know that's just not how it works in everybody's brain. As a professor, of course, this poses a big problem. I have to have a way of evaluating how much work you've done, how well you understand the material, and this course involves both quantitative questions, because of the data we discuss, and more interpretive and concept-based questions. And I've never been able to satisfactorily figure out a way that doesn't, I've not been able to figure out a way that's not as sensitive to people's particular test-taking capacities. Because I don't care at all about your test-taking ability. That's not what I want to test. I don't want to test how good you are at taking tests. I want to test how well you've assimilated the material. I'm going on and on about this because obviously I feel a little guilty when I give tests that some people do badly at when it isn't because they haven't done the work. I consider that a failure of the system. The system shouldn't be like that. It should not give you tasks that don't reflect how much you've studied and learned in a course. But I haven't been able to find a solution. Okay, enough of my confession of my own bad feelings about this issue. I will have office hours this afternoon. Mostly my office hours are spent in lonely isolation for whatever reasons. Relatively few of you have come to visit me. I just want to reiterate, of course, this is the Thursday before the exam. That's a special kind of office hour. But in general, you know, we've got another month or so of the semester. One of the reasons I have office hours is not merely to give you an opportunity to come and ask me questions and have a more informal way of chatting. It's actually valuable to me because it's a way for me to get to know some of you in the class in a more personal way, which I genuinely enjoy and value. So it's an open invitation, of course, today for the more instrumental purpose, if you have some confusion about any of the issues in the we've been covering. But for the rest of the semester, you've gotten to know me from me standing up here talking to you every Tuesday and Thursday. In the last part of the semester, then, if some of you would like, it would be a chance for me to get to know you a little if you come by and visit during my office hours. Okay, last time we did a rapid tour through the massive transformations that have occurred in the gender structure of the United States. Some bigger than others, some incomplete. So on some of the topics, I sort of emphasized how far we've come, and on others, how far we still need to go. If you were paying attention to the elections on Tuesday, you'll note that my slides for the percentage of women in U.S. Congress is now out of date. That will have to be updated because there were a lot of women elected to the U.S. Senate, including our very own Tammy Baldwin, who I think is at a personal level. Of course, I am sympathetic to her political positions, as I'm sure you figured out by now, but at a personal level, she's just a really genuinely warm and authentic person. She's not a cynical politician just simply angling to make her way in politics. She'll be, I think, a refreshing figure in the Senate once she gets her legs firmly on the ground there. Well, that chart is a little out of date now. You know, the next time I teach the class, there'll be a nicer curve on the power section because women are making bigger headways now in the on the American political scene. So what we've done, though, the basic punchline of all of that is massive change, really world historical transformations that we're living through, and yet they're not complete. And they're not complete in ways which cause all sorts of dilemmas in people's lives. One of the arenas where they're not complete has to do with transformations in the most intimate spheres where gender relations are lived and created, namely within families, around the division of labor. And so we are now in a period of history where many women want careers and have ambitions in the public world every bit as strong and passionate as men, and they want families and children because that's a deep part not just of their gender identities but of their human needs to have and raise children. And because the transformations of gender relations in the micro settings of people's families have not kept pace with the transformations in the public sphere of opportunities for women, we're living in a period of pretty sharp tension around how to organize your private life and make it compatible with your public ambitions. That's a tension. One of the manifestations of that tension is delayed childbearing, for example. The average age at which women, especially highly educated women, of which you will all be by the time you finish your university education, the average age of first child is way, way older than it used to be, partially for that reason, because people want to get their career started. They feel like having a child will impede them, and they know from both their personal experience with friends and older siblings and so on, and just what they read and understand about the world, that taking time out of the labor force early in a career can permanently disable your career prospects. You sort of fall behind your age cohort if you take a bunch of years off with small children. So this is a tension. And the new rules of the game have not settled down. You can think of some times in history where there's an equilibrium. Everything fits together nicely. The rules that enforce the constraints on your lives and your preferences and identities for what kind of lives you want to live, they kind of all fit together in a way that leads to relatively smooth sailing. Now, that doesn't mean that people live fulfilling lives necessarily under those stable rules. The stable rules can be stable subordination, after all. But at least you don't have this feeling of anxiety that everything is up for grabs and you don't know which way to turn, or what, as I mentioned the expression, a sociologist has dubbed an era of gender vertigo, kind of confusion, imbalance. We don't have an equilibrium yet. You are the generation that will help forge the new equilibrium. You'll be forging it as you form families and figure out how in the hell you're going to manage to combine the different kinds of, or different dimensions of your lives that you want to live. It's a difficult issue. And one of the questions we'll be addressing towards the end of this lecture is, are there ways in which we can create new institutions, new environments in which people live, that make these transitions easier, that make it easier for people to figure out how to forge the equilibrium that's best for them? Or are there things we're doing which make it increasingly difficult? That's one of the issues. That's the way I like to think about social change and public policy, building new institutions. What can we do to make it easier for people to sort these things out for themselves? It's not a question of my wanting to ask the question, how can I do things to impose new gender relations on people, whether they want it or not? It's more, what can we do to make it easier for people to navigate these problems and forge the new equilibrium that works best for them? All right, so that's what we've done. Now the next task is, how do we explain what's happened? And if we can sort of figure out a good explanation for what's happened, that will help set the stage for what are the solutions to the dilemmas we currently face. How do we explain this? So I began by stating the question. The question basically begins with an observation that there's always been efforts by women to create more autonomy and reduce their subjugation. Why has it been the case that in the second half of the 20th century, suddenly these transformations and their efforts to create new relations, why did they suddenly begin to succeed? And the broad answer is that whether or not people can succeed in creating new conditions for their own life depends upon ways in which existing institutions become vulnerable to transformation. They can only succeed in these changes on a large scale once social conditions had changed, which made the existing relations fragile. And this is a particular example of a big idea. So this is another one of these major lessons to learn from this course, to take away from the class and apply to all sorts of other settings. We didn't discuss the civil rights movement and how it came to pass that in the era of America, in the context of American race relations, suddenly in the 1950s and 60s, an edifice which had been around for three centuries in one form or another, first slavery and then segregation, suddenly the attacks on it succeeded. Why did the struggles of the civil rights movement gain in strength and succeed in destroying legal racism in the United States? That is, the legal form of state-sponsored racism, which had existed since colonial times. So by 1960, it had been around for 300 years in different forms. Why did it succeed in 1960s when it had failed in the 1920s and the 1870s? Why did it suddenly succeed? Well, the general perspective on how you approach an answer to the question is to not simply look at the strength of the movement. Of course, that's important. The civil rights movement was a big deal. Hundreds of thousands of people, millions probably, if you counted everybody who was involved in some kind of protest or activity, were involved in combating the system. But the intensity of the struggle and the mobilization is never enough to explain a transformation. You also have to look at what made the institutions vulnerable. Why did they suddenly become weak? When previously, if they faced protests, they simply arrested everybody, or they sent out the Ku Klux Klan or whatever. You know, all sorts of methods of repressing struggles and preventing change. Well, the story for the civil rights movement is super interesting. We didn't discuss it. Let me just, as long as I'm having this digression, let me just give you two points about why suddenly it succeeds in the 1960s, whereas it didn't before. There's two things I think that are really important to understand. One is the change in the relationship of the United States to the rest of the world and what it meant for us to have legal segregation in terms of our role in the world. That helps explain why the federal government's relationship to segregation changed. That's one point. And the second point is changes in the South, which made segregation no longer in the interests of Southern elites in the same way that it had been in earlier times. That first point about the American relationship to the rest of the world, it was the Cold War. We were in this global geopolitical struggle with the Soviet Union. Africa was decolonizing, Asia was decolonizing, there were new states forming all around the world. We had just fought a war against the Nazis, a war that was fought against racial domination, a particularly virulent form of racial ideology in a racialized state, in the case of the Nazis. And we were combating, on a global ideological level, the Soviet Union and communist ideology, which proclaimed the universality of humanity. And it was very hard for us to portray ourselves globally as the champions of freedom and democracy when we had legalized slavery, legalized segregation in the South. So one of the things that changed and made those institutions more vulnerable is they no longer could simply be our, so to speak, our dirty little secret in our backyard. They became a prominent weapon of our opponents in the global struggle for ideological dominance. It was a big embarrassment to the United States that we had legalized segregation when we were trying to combat communism in Africa and other places. So one of the things that made our local institutions vulnerable had to do with our global relation. That's why struggles got more support nationally, one reason. The other thing was that the South had changed. Until the 1930s, the dominant elites in the South gained their wealth primarily, or to a very large extent, through a particular form of agriculture called sharecropping, which depended for its success on a highly repressive form of labor control in the rural areas of the South, which was reinforced by Southern segregation. By the 1950s, sharecropping had virtually disappeared in the South. The combination of the Great Depression in the 1930s and the migration of African Americans north during the Second World War and after had basically destroyed the foundations of sharecropping. And so the Southern elites no longer had as big a stake in maintaining segregation, which was an instrument for maintaining sharecropping. So that weakened the resistance to the civil rights movement in the South, and then this global transformation made the American government much more eager to get rid of this embarrassment. Those are two crucial changes, which then meant once you had a mobilization around civil rights, suddenly they could succeed where in the past they had failed. So that's the way you tell this kind of story. If you're trying to analyze a process of social change in which the grievances have been around for a very long time, the grievances of African Americans had been around forever. The grievances of women around subordination, limited opportunities, restrictions on their rights, on their autonomy, those grievances had been around. It's not that women weren't aware of this and that they didn't object to it and that they didn't struggle in all sorts of ways around those issues. If you talk to your grandparents about the worlds in which they grew up, they will tell you, at least some of them, if they, you know, think about it, will tell you about forms of resistance that occurred, why women, even under those conditions 50 years ago, were not just complacently happy about everything. But suddenly, a breakthrough occurs, beginning in the, particularly in the 1960s and then dramatically accelerating. Well, how do we explain it? Here's what I would argue for. These are all discussed at length in the chapter in the book. Three basic processes explain why it is that suddenly, and I mean suddenly, this is pretty sudden by historic standards, gender relations begin to undergo such a strong process of change and makes them vulnerable to attack. So that the formal, the institutions that were discriminating can then be challenged. First, there's a decline in the coherent interest among men to defend male domination. So one of the things that would makes it hard for women to struggle for more autonomy, more opportunity, is if men are united in opposing this. So remember the very beginning of the course where I laid out these basic elements of sociological thinking, where I said that the key idea is that there are rules which govern our relationships, our activities, and those rules are defended by power. So the rules of the game aren't just given by nature, they're defended by power. And particularly if some people benefit from the existing rules, and if they also have power, if the rules both benefit them and give them power, that reinforces the rules, right? That was that very abstract set of initial points to set the stage for thinking sociologically about these things. Well, that's what you would bring then to the question of gender. Gender relations are enforced by rules. Certain things women weren't supposed to do, they would be sanctioned. There'd be consequences if they deviated or they faced very big difficulties. One of the things which made those rules stable was that they were defended by men. Men enforced the rules on women. And then many women collaborated with men in enforcing these rules on other women. So one of the things that affects the fate of gender in the US and in the world is that the coherent interest of men, that is that all of their interests lined up in the same way, that's what coherence means. It all fits together in a nice package. The coherence of the interests of men in defending male domination begins to decline. Secondly, there's an erosion of an institutional system which I think Kathleen Gerson, a well-known gender and family sociologist at NYU, described as the system of female domesticity. There was an erosion of the institutional system of female domesticity which eroded women's interest in traditional gender relations. Now this is a really interesting twist in this story. The stability of the old order rested on men having an interest in maintaining the subordination of women, and then a form of life developing for women given those rules in which women also developed interests in those traditional relations. That's, you can see why that really stabilizes things. If you can manage to create a set of interests of women in preserving the traditional order, and men preserving it, that makes it very tough to combat. Well, there's also then an erosion of the institutional system of female domesticity. And then finally, there was an increase in the capacity for challenge by women. The first two elements explain why the system becomes more fragile. The third explains why there was a greater capacity to take advantage of that fragility to actually produce transformation. That's the basic structure of the argument. Now let's look at each of these pieces. First, the decline of a coherent male interest in male domination. Here the central explanation, I think, is economic. Basically, I'm not saying that you can explain everything by changes in the economy, but the changes in the economy after World War II fundamentally changed the interests of men particularly male employers and male managers, with respect to the relationship of women to the labor force. The rapidly increasing demand for literate labor that is well schooled in reading and in writing, in ability to learn new things, so they have the meta skill, knowing how to learn, and also numeracy skills. The rapid economic demand for such labor by male employers, because most employers were men after all, and most managers were men, undermined male interest in excluding women. So just think of the situation. The 1950s, it's a period of sustained economic development, a very big boom, low unemployment. But more importantly, the technological changes that were occurring, the kind of economy that was developing, required ever-increasing numbers of people to do what was essentially low-level clerical kinds of work. Clerical and administrative work and educational work and things like this that required literacy and basic education. Now, where are the pools of labor that you could tap to fill the demand for such jobs? To take the simplest case, if you're having a rapid expansion of the service sector and of administrative duties within large organizations, both state bureaucracies and corporations, and you need lots of typists and secretaries and personal assistants, where in the United States in the 1950s would you expect to find a big pool of available labor for those kinds of tasks? Immigration was a solution to labor shortages in the 19th century, but the problem with immigrants, unless they happen to be immigrants from Australia or England, is that they don't speak English, and they're not easily inserted into the administrative hierarchy for such kinds of basic clerical and other administrative tasks. Well, I think the answer is obvious. There was this fantastically well-educated pool of available labor, namely educated women, who had been educated, that is, they all, you know, they had high school completion rates, which is where you get basic literacy and the academic level that was of relevance in the 1950s, and increasingly began to get university educations as well. They were an untapped labor pool, and men had an interest in bringing them into the labor market. Now, I think that was the key driving force that erodes the other supports for the subordination of women. It's the key driving force because of the way it disrupts the role of women within the household and the family. This massive increase in the demand for literate labor was kicked off during World War II because of the huge labor supply shortages of male labor. So many women gained experience in the labor force during World War II. That wasn't quite sufficient to maintain the new structure. After World War II and the GIs came home, most women who had been employed, married women who had been employed during World War II, the iconic Rosie the Riveter, mostly they went back to domestic work within the home. But that disruptive experience then was the first move in shattering this view that women's place was in the home, that they couldn't function well or they shouldn't function in the public sphere. And then when these new economic demands took off in the 1950s, there was this massive movement of women into the labor force as the best untapped labor supply to respond to the economic requirements of that period. The result of this was a kind of incoherence. Remember, we moved from a coherent system of interest. Now you have men with an incoherent interest. You have male employers and male managers who have an interest in attracting women into the labor force to satisfy their labor needs, But they are also fathers and husbands in their household who have an interest in women staying in the home to attend to their personal needs. You have, therefore, no longer an alignment of their interests. And that's what it means to say that the interests of men, particularly of powerful men, men who control institutions, their interests become more confused with respect to the issue of what's the appropriate role for women. Okay, that's the first element. The second element is the crisis of female domesticity. The crisis of female domesticity. This refers to a transformation of a system in which, in the private lives of people, all sorts of arrangements reinforced the role of women in the home. The model of the male breadwinner and the woman who is the mother and wife, and her job in life is that of mothering and domestic work in the house and housework. The expression housewife captures that role. The traditional system of domesticity was a coherent system. Coherence, again, is a nice word to think about here. Coherence means there's all sorts of elements in place stably that reinforce each other. So it really is a system in the sense that all the pieces fit together. And when they all fit together coherently, it's harder for an individual to simply break out of them. What are the elements of the coherent system? First, stable marriages, stable personal relations. This fosters domesticity for a variety of reasons. It encourages dependency of women on their husbands because there's a long time horizon. If you have a divorce rate of 10%, if it's a rare experience, that means that when you get married, barring catastrophes, of course there were disruptions, there were deaths, there were other things that would disrupt a marriage, but you could count on the bargain that you would stay, if you were a woman, you would stay home, raise the kids, take care of the house, and your husband would provide for your well-being, and you didn't have to worry about what would happen if the marriage dissolves, because it was a rare event. This reinforces the sense of the role of mother and wife as natural, and the slogan, the woman's place is in the home, as a reasonable expectation given the long time horizons in which people could count on that relation enduring. Stable marriages are the first component of the traditional system. Secondly, blocked work opportunities meant that domesticity was actually more attractive. If all you can get is really lousy jobs and they're really hard to get, well, then the retreat into the domestic sphere, which is secure and has this long time horizon, isn't such a bad deal. Blocked opportunities make, particularly if those blocks are seen as natural, that's just the way the world is, makes the alternative seem more attractive. Third, and this was a really important thing in the 1950s, I would say. One might have expected the experience of World War II to have done more damage to the traditional model of domesticity than it did. What prevented that in a significant way is what's called the family wage. The family wage is the idea that one wage earner in a family can bring in enough income to provide a reasonable, stable, secure standard of living for everybody, so that the male breadwinner could be the sole wage earner. That's referred to as the family wage. And the family wage provides an attractive support for domesticity, especially if it's rising over time, which it was in the 1950s, rising steadily. In fact, it was rising steadily well into the 1960s. This reduces pressures on households for wives to go out and earn income. Especially for middle-class families, this became a reality. Families could survive very comfortably on a single earner, and there was no severe economic pressure. There might be other reasons why women might still want to work outside the home, but there would be no severe economic pressure on them to do so. Family wage is a key element. The family wage is something that was fought for by labor unions. The reason why a family wage was available to a large segment of the American population was not because of the benevolence of employers. You know, it's not that employers sat back and said, gee, we should pay a family wage because that will create a stable male workforce and they'll be able to support a wife at home who will provide all these nice family services for them. Yes, we should pay men a family wage. No, that's not how a family wage occurred. A family wage occurred because it was fought for by organized employees or unions. Fourth, there were strong cultural supports for domesticity. The sheer fact that it was such a common choice that most women chose lives of domesticity added credibility to that choice. What was normal in the sense of average behavior became normative. These are two words that have a similar root, right? Normal and normative. Normative means it's what people feel they ought to do. Normal is just what most people do, right? So it's not always the case that what's normal is also normative. There are some things that most people do that don't ever become normative. That is, they don't become something that people feel they ought to do, but they still do it. But typically, if something is normal, if most people do it, it also becomes viewed as culturally normative, as things that people ought to do. And that was an important aspect of the cultural supports for domesticity. The sheer fact it was such a common choice meant that it was a culturally supported choice. There were also, I see that in my notes, I talk about this, the order is different from the order on here. So I've basically talked about cultural norms. These are also reinforced by sexism. There was just outright sexist propaganda about the appropriate roles for women that reinforced the cultural normality of women playing those roles as well. There was also, and this is, I think, an especially interesting feature, there was a dense social network of interactions between people that also supported domesticity. This is embodied in the way neighborhoods were organized in the 1950s. In the 1950s, on a typical residential street in the United States, a large majority of families would have children and have wives staying at home, which meant that during the day they weren't isolated. Just think of the contrast between being a stay-at-home mom in a setting where there are a dozen stay-at-home moms within a 2-minute walk of you, so that the possibility of having daily interactions and mutual support, dropping your kids off at a neighbor's house while you go and do an errand, all these things that are made easy if lots of people do it. Compare that with the situation where the large majority of mothers with children under 6 are back in the labor force. Suddenly, the few moms who are stay-at-home moms become much more isolated. It becomes logistically harder to be a stay-at-home mom in a world where there are few stay-at-home moms than in a world where most people are stay-at-home moms. That makes it easier. And that's this dense network of social support that emerges in neighborhoods by virtue of this being the standard model. All of that then constitutes a coherent system. You know, if you were to write a script, basically, if you were just doing this theoretically, there are sociologists and economists who do mathematical models of these things. And one of the things you try to do in a mathematical model is you basically specify a whole set of rules, and if they're all in place, and you can specify how they feed back and reinforce each other, then the whole thing is stabilized. And then you can ask the question, what happens if you remove one element. You change one element. Well, if you've got enough stabilizing interconnections, you can change one little bit, but the whole system still locks itself in as stable. But if you begin to change all the bits, then suddenly the system becomes much more fragile. That's what happens beginning in the 60s and accelerating thereafter. There's a decline of stable marriage. This means that women cannot count on the permanent support of husbands. Now, if you, most people when they get married expect to stay married. I think it's not the case that most people when they decide to get married say, aha, this is great, we got a 50-50 chance of staying together 5 years from now. No, that's not the general attitude. People fall in love, they have all sorts of reasons to get married. But it's a very different world if you get married and you know there's only a 10% chance of things falling apart, and you get married and you just know from the way the world is that it's a pretty common event for marriages to dissolve. If you live in a world where there's a common chance for marriages to dissolve, it's a smart thing to have insurance against that possibility. Well, insurance in this sense means being able to get a job that will pay you enough to live on. And the way to ensure that possibility is to stay in the labor force. So one of the things which disrupts that stable domesticity world is the instability of marriages. Secondly, and that's the one that I emphasized at the very beginning, the massive expansion of work opportunities increased the viability of alternatives to domesticity. So even if domesticity became a shakier proposition, if you didn't have opportunities to get employment, you might not be able to act on the anxiety created by the instability of marriage. The decline of the family wage, which begins in the late 1960s, and then becomes basically a permanent feature of the United States economy starting in the 70s. That is, we no longer have a family wage. For most people in the middle of the income distribution, if they want their household to be in the middle of the income distribution, both partners have to work. A single earner for most households cannot provide enough income to provide for what's seen as the kind of culturally acceptable middling level of income. The decline of the family wage made domesticity economically difficult. And underlying the decline of the family wage is the massive decline in the capacity of unions to defend the working conditions and wages of their members. There was also an erosion of the dense social networks. That is, as women entered the labor force and had much shorter discontinuities, they would stay out of the labor force for a very short period of time with the birth of a child. And associated with this, of course, and for most communities in the United States, a quite significant decline in the average number of children women have. There were fewer women around, fewer stay-at-home moms in any given neighborhood, which made it tougher, made the task of domesticity a harder job than it used to be. And then finally, there's been this enormous challenge to the cultural norms and traditional sexism, which eroded this one-dimensional identity that women were expected to have with respect to domesticity. Now, I don't think that women's identities, for that matter, men's identities, with respect to parenting, being mothers and fathers, has eroded dramatically. Some, but not dramatically. What's eroded is the identity of mothering as the sole legitimate identity for women. And that erosion undermines this system of coherence of domesticity that was so prevalent in the earlier period. So this is the second component. So we got these three processes. Remember, just to tell you what we're doing here. The massive economic changes disrupts the interests of men with respect to the subordination of women. And the erosion of domesticity as the standard model in which women live their lives erodes the interests that women have in preserving their, or going along with, I should say, their subordination to men. Whoops, that was a little quick. That was an even quicker discussion of that topic than I had intended. There. All of this set the stage for the women's movement emerging in the course of the 1960s and playing a very critical role in demands for the end to formal discrimination and the advance of women's rights in the 1970s. In the 1970s, the women's movement was a very big deal. There were big demonstrations. I mean, I'm sure you're aware of some of this. There were demonstrations that had a kind of symbolic aggressiveness to them. The public burning of bras was a sort of symbolic act of the 1970s. It had a certain symbolic connection to an important part of the protests of the 1960s, where the symbolic act was men burning their draft cards. You know, the draft card was the official card you had to carry for being conscripted into the army and into the military. And as part of the anti-war movement against the Vietnam War, young men in the 1960s would have a public event, not just individually, where they would all burn their draft cards. Well, burning of bras was a kind of symbolic connection between those two historic types of protest activities. There were big demonstrations. One of the focal points of that was the Equal Rights Amendment, an amendment to the Constitution, which was proposed in the 1970s. And ultimately failed to pass enough states. The Equal Rights Amendment was very simple. It simply said that women in all respects had equal rights to men. I mean, the actual wording wasn't that, but that was all it said. It needed to pass, I forget what the constitutional rule for the number of states, I believe it's 34 it had to pass. You know, somebody could easily check that. It failed by one or two states, particularly southern states opposed it. It seems to me pretty odd nowadays when women in the military are in combat situations, right? So this has become it's not an ordinary thing in people's lives, of course, but it's part of the way the military works today. The arguments against equal rights to women is that it would mean that women would have to be drafted into the military. And there were even arguments of a sort that were sort of nonsensical, that if we had equal rights for women, then we couldn't have sex-segregated bathrooms in public places. That was an argument against equal rights. Kind of absurd. You could only have unisex bathrooms if you had equal rights. There is actually an interesting, this is a Madison thing, Madison has an ordinance that was affectionately called the Potty Parity Ordinance, which says that in all public buildings, new construction of public buildings, the number of bathroom stalls in women's rooms has to be large enough that the average waiting time for women and men would be the same. So you'd have basically bigger facilities for women. That was the implication of equality. This was particularly relevant to things like large entertainment venues where you have an intermission. And as I'm sure you all have had the experience, the lines outside of the women's rooms stretch into the hallways. The men go in and out like that. And the argument was, okay, this is an example of where you have a sex difference, not a gender difference. Right? It's a sex difference that it's quicker for men to use the restroom during an intermission than women. So the way you create equality is just have bigger facilities for women. And there is a potty parity ordinance that is supposed to mandate that. Of course, it requires a certain amount of research to figure out exactly what the proportionate sizes should be to accomplish that goal. All right, the Equal Rights Movement, the Equal Rights Amendment was the focus of the women's movement and its protests. It failed in actually passing, but massively succeeded in creating a context in which ongoing discrimination against women, official bars to women being employed in certain kinds of jobs, official bars to women being promoted to certain kinds of positions, that has virtually disappeared in the United States. There are a few vestiges of formal discrimination, legally permitted discrimination against women, but they are really vestiges. The recent controversy over the holding of the Masters golf tournament in the Augusta National Golf Course, which does not, or did not until recently, allow women as members, that was viewed as no longer really tolerable, that you'd have a important, publicly, symbolically important American institution that bars women as members. Just because it called itself a private club, well, the Masters tournament is a big public event, even if it's held on a private golf course, and even if the PGA, the Professional Golfers Association, is technically a private association. Still, the idea that they could have discrimination no longer seems acceptable to most people. They certainly, nobody would imagine it legitimate if the PGA said no blacks could be members. You know, that would be viewed as just absurd at this point in history. That the Augusta Golf Course said no blacks could be members and blacks couldn't compete on their course. That gender remains even today in this vestigial form present indicates that it's not a simple matter to eliminate it, but still the fact is it is a last remnant. And that's, I think, to a very significant extent because of the strength of the women's movement in demanding that these changes be made. But they succeeded in those demands because the coherence of the interests opposing them had crumbled. Well, that's where we've come from. Those are the processes which underwrote the transformations. Now let's think about the dilemmas in the world today and prospects for further change. So let's just begin with a kind of imaginary, treat this as an imaginary worlds. They turn out to be reasonable descriptions of actual worlds, but let's just imagine these two possibilities. Here's the first world. The average wages of women and men are about the same. Women are earning 95-98% of what men earn in terms of their hourly wage. There's good quality childcare provided by the government or employers, free or at low cost, so that everybody has available childcare that's convenient, good quality, and affordable. And for that to happen, it is underwritten by public funding. And there's generous paid parental leave for caregiving emergencies and for the early infant child care. So that employers or the government, so it's a combination of employers having to pay as a benefit parental leave and the government subsidizing it. As a right, parents don't have disruptions in their income when they have an emergency to take care of children or for early infant child care. So that's one possible world. A second possible world is that the average wages of women are 75 to 80% of men. There's no child care provided by government or employers. Private daycare is expensive and good quality or cheap and bad quality. And there's no paid parental leave for caregiving emergencies or early infant care unless an employer benevolently agrees to it. That is, there's no requirements at all that there be paid parental leave with the birth of a child or for family emergencies. This is pretty much the way it is in Sweden. And this is pretty much the way it is in the United States. These are two possible worlds. So if you imagine living in these two kinds of worlds, just think about the dilemmas and choices people face around how to balance work, family, housework, childcare. What kind of choices do you think men and women are likely to make under these two different conditions? How easy do you think it is for people to figure out what the best balance of these things are in terms of their own priorities? How would it affect your choices? I mean, if you're thinking about the timing of children, which of these two worlds would lead you to say, let's time our children depending upon when we want them, rather than let's delay childbearing until it's least costly for us? Well, you can see my point. I'm belaboring it, I think, that this world is one in which parents have more freedom to make those choices based on their own life plans. So there, whereas this is one which actually imposes deeper constraints and dilemmas in the way people navigate these choices. Another way of saying it, and I don't, this might seem contentious, like I'm, you know, saying this in a particular, with a particular ideological slant to it. I suppose it's also true that I am. I think it's also, though, a factually correct description. The greater level of public support for children and for women's autonomy in this system actually constitutes greater freedom for people. Not less freedom. More public support creates more freedom. Less public support, a system that leaves everybody on their own and seems to interfere in their lives less, right? You know, everybody's on their own, everybody's responsible for their own choices, everybody has to make their own way. That seems to be a situation where people have less interference, but it actually reduces their freedom, not increases it. That, of course, is one of the deep ironies and puzzles that this I've been emphasizing in different ways throughout this course. More public support doesn't mean less freedom, if by freedom we mean the ability of people to put their life plans into place. If that's the if that's the real guts of the meaning of freedom, I think world number one is a world of more freedom than world number two. Second point I'd like to make, the prospects for the future. The fundamental prospects for the future, the fundamental thing to keep in mind, I think, is the deep irreversibility of the basic changes we have observed. I don't see us going backwards, going back to the earlier model. I think it's almost inconceivable that 50 years from now we will be back to the 1950s, right? That we will ever return to a situation where only 10% of married women are in the labor force. I just cannot imagine a dramatic unraveling of the transformations of gender relations which we've observed. The dramatic decline in family size is unlikely to be reversed. There's a permanent erosion of lifetime domesticity as an ideal. Traditional marriage stability is unlikely to be restored. It's not obvious to me that a divorce rate of somewhere between 30 and 50% is high or low. I don't know. Should people stay together if they're miserable in each other's company? You know, it's a complicated matter to know whether a low divorce rate is a good thing if what a low divorce rate means is that people live lives where they're unhappy by virtue of incompatibility in their relationships. It's a complicated matter, but in any case, as a prediction, I don't think we'll ever return to a traditional pattern of marriage stability where divorce is shunned, where it's viewed as a blot on your life, and in which very few people dissolve either a marriage or a cohabiting partnership. A women's labor force participation is very unlikely to be reversed, and women's position in powerful and influential positions, I think, are going to continue to expand, not decline. So the world we are in is not going to be transformed back to the world we've left. And that means that as we think about what to do about the dilemmas in the world in which we live, the world in which we live, I think, has to be taken as irreversible. Now, there is a problem in all this, which I haven't focused on too much. It's the problem of what could be thought of as winners and losers. Gender equality imposes costs on some women and erodes the security that comes from the traditional form of female dependency. So I don't think the simple point that the transformation of gender relations has opened up possibilities for human flourishing, especially for women, that this is a better world with respect to the possibilities for human flourishing for women today than 50 or 100 years ago. I don't think that the implication of that is that it's benefited all women. It's made some women's lives more precarious, more anxious, more insecure, and has reduced the flourishing possibilities for some people. Certain ways of life valued by many women and men are threatened by gender equality. So it's not just a simple matter of there being only winners and the losers are simply unenlightened. Men, I think, have contradictory interests with respect to gender inequality. I personally think men have much more to gain from equality than to lose. The gains for men, above all, are opening up of choices around parenting and work that are blocked by the norms of male roles in the traditional model of gender relations. The cult of masculinity blocks the full development of personhood in men. For the guys in the room, I think you really should take that seriously. Gender equality is in your interests, even if you have to give up some things, some certain kinds of privileges that men have, both sexual privileges and work privileges. On balance, I think the opening up of new ways of flourishing and living a deep and multidimensional life is enhanced by a deeply egalitarian structure of gender relations for men. But there are losses for men. More competition for higher jobs. You know, if 50% of legislators become women, it means that some men who would like to be legislators aren't going to be legislators. They're going to lose in elections to women. That's the only way you can have it. If there's upward mobility for women into positions of power, it definitely means that the opportunities for men will decline. There's no way, because in those positions of power, there's a limited supply of positions. So equality does mean some losses for men. For some men, those losses are sufficient for them to resist the transformation of gender. Okay, in the final few minutes, let me briefly discuss three reforms, three things that I think should be done that would make gender equality advance to new levels and would enhance the ability of people to cope with the transformations that are occurring. The first is the simplest, perhaps. It goes under the name of pay equity. Pay equity. There's two different ideas around the issue of pay and gender. One is equal pay for identical work, and the other is equal pay for equivalent work. Now, equal pay for identical work is the simplest. That is, a police officer with 3 years of experience in a particular grade of whatever the hierarchies of police officers should be paid the same whether they are a man or a woman. That's equal pay for identical work. That's already the law of the land. employers are not allowed to pay women and men different rates of pay for doing exactly the same thing with the same experience. A more complicated idea is equal pay for equivalent work. This says that two jobs that have equivalent levels of skills and responsibilities should be paid the same. This is also called comparable worth. Comparable worth. If you hear the expression comparable worth with respect to gender equity, it's referring to this second principle. That is, two jobs with equivalent levels of skill and responsibility should be paid the same. This is important because of what's called the sex typing of jobs, that some jobs are associated with female labor and others with male labor. And typically, there's a pay penalty for jobs that are labeled female jobs. So that we get various kinds of anomalies where daycare workers, which is a typically female job, are on average paid less than parking attendants in the United States, which is a typically male job. And by no stretch of the imagination does being a parking attendant involve more skill and responsibility than being a daycare worker. Pay equity in the strong sense of demanding comparable worth, equal pay for work of equivalent skills and responsibility, is a much more demanding rule, but it's a rule which, if put in place, would dramatically reduce the inequality in the wages of women and men. The second thing, quality child care assistance. I think I jumped the gun here. Quality public provision of child care in neighborhoods and workplaces. There's no way that the market is going to provide high quality, affordable child care for most families. It's just impossible. Either if the market does it, it'll be cheap because you'll pay the daycare workers little and you'll get overcrowded child care facilities with underskilled daycare providers, or it'll be good quality but very expensive. In Quebec, they have a system of child care provision which costs parents about $8 a day for full-time child care. The child care centers are not organized by private companies. They're organized in what are called solidarity cooperatives. That is, they're nonprofit community centers governed by the daycare workers, by parents, and by community members, and subsidized by the provincial government. The idea is that a daycare worker gets their wages from two sources, the $8 a day provided by parents and about $25 a day per child provided by the province. That provides enough support that the daycare workers in Quebec have starting salaries around $33,000 a year, a little over twice what the average American daycare worker earns. That's what you need to do if you're going to have good quality daycare. And I think it should be a public responsibility, because investing in good quality daycare is an essential part of providing the environment in which families can make choices. Paid parental leave is another reform that I think is crucial. This shows the amount of paid leave provided by law in different countries. In Sweden, when you have a child, you're entitled to almost a full year of paid parental leave. In the United States, it's zero. You know, this is one of these cases where we're not just lower than other countries, we're in a different kind of world. We have requirements now that there be unpaid leave provided by employers if the employers employ more than 50 employees. And unpaid leave is relevant, of course. It enables people to stay home with their with newborn babies for, I think, 12 weeks is the unpaid leave provision. That was fought strenuously when it was debated in Congress as being something that would bankrupt small businesses that they could not afford to give unpaid leave to families. Whereas all these other countries require substantial amounts of paid leave. Parental leave is a really interesting set of policies. It's interesting because the details of the design of paid leave have big implications for how families organize their lives. In Sweden, when they instituted this very generous paid leave system, initially, it was almost entirely taken by women. So it was, in effect, maternity leave, not parental leave. They have subsequently, over the years, men have gradually taken up more and more, but it's still way disproportionately taken up by women. What the Swedish government did more recently was to allocate some of these weeks exclusively for men. It's a use it or lose it provision to basically force fathers to take some of the paid parental leave. That's turned out to be a very good policy because once that policy was instituted, fathers also started taking some of the unallocated part. So if you have a total of, let's say, 50 weeks a year available, and 3 weeks are only for fathers, and 47 can be divided up however the family wants to. If you force fathers to take 3 weeks, they end up taking 10. If you don't force them to take 3, they'll only take 5. You see, so what happens by giving them the forcing them to take 3 is it actually gets them into the routine and the pleasures of participating actively in early child care. And so that's a policy that actually then has ramifications for how families cope with and divide up the child care internally. Okay, we're out of time. Next Tuesday is the exam, and then we begin the section on democracy. See you.